Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Sign up to be a paid member and get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and exclusive bonus episodes that we'll make just for you. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
Spies. Saboteurs. Assassins. We've all done terrible things on behalf of the rebellion.
Cassian Andor. Don't matter what you tell me or tell yourself. You'll ultimately die fighting these bastards. Wouldn't you rather give it all at once to something real?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV. I'm David Chen. Since Decoding TV began, my vision has been for this podcast and the YouTube channel at youtube.com/decodingTV to be recapping and reviewing multiple TV shows at once with a bunch of really awesome co-hosts. And folks such as yourself can tune in to whichever ones you're interested in. We're already recapping She-Hulk Attorney at Law with Siddharth Adlaka right now, as well as The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power with Don Marshall. And today, I'm pleased to announce that we'll be recapping Andor, the newest show set in the Star Wars universe that's premiering on Disney Plus on September 21st. And I'm so pleased to announce that I will have a brand new co-host for our recaps and reviews of Andor. He is a filmmaker, video essayist, and someone whose work has brought me a great deal of enlightenment and joy over the years. You've seen him at youtube.com/Patrick H. Willems. Patrick H. Willems, welcome to Decoding TV.
David, it is a pleasure to be here. You got me. You convinced me to go on the internet and talk about Star Wars again. And all I'm going to say is there are not many people who could get me to do that. And so,
well, let's talk a little bit about that, right? So before we, so in this inaugural kickoff episode of our coverage of Andor, we are going to be discussing Rogue One, the movie for which Andor is a prequel series to.
A Star Wars story.
Indeed. Rogue One, a Star Wars story. So that's what is going to be the bulk of this episode of the podcast and YouTube video. But before we talk about that, I think it's important to talk about what our relationship has been to Star Wars over the last few years and why we're talking about Andor specifically. Now, Patrick H. Willems, you alluded to it just now, but you have sworn off talking about Star Wars in any of your videos. And I guess I am curious, A, why is that the case? And B, why come back to do Andor on Decoding TV with me?
That's a good question, David. And to be very clear, because I know people on the internet are going to try to be like, gotcha.
Let's clear it up right now.
Back in early 2020, I proclaimed that I was done making Star Wars videos like on my channel.
Yes.
That does not mean I can never discuss Star Wars. As much as I generally avoid talking about Star Wars, doesn't mean I can't ever talk about it or do podcasts about it. I'm just not gonna make video essays on my channel about Star Wars anymore.
And why was that, Patrick? Why is that the case?
I think like many people, in December 2019, I experienced a profound feeling of disappointment and sadness watching episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. It is my least favorite Star Wars film. And I was really bummed out by that movie. And as I was sort of, having like alcohol-fueled post-film discussion with a friend about that movie and what it seems like Star Wars is now, I was realizing that it seems like the way Star Wars had been going, pretty much almost everything after The Last Jedi, whether it was let's make a Han Solo origin movie, let's do The Rise of Skywalker, let's make The Mandalorian, which I enjoy some of, but also largely seems to be like, you know, let's play with our action figures in a very safe place and just use the old toy. It seemed like Star Wars was only interested in rehashing the past and being about how much we like old Star Wars and not moving forward and very much catering to the audience that just wants things to be like they always used to be. And I'm, as much as I love the original trilogy, that's not what I'm especially interested in. And I kind of realized that what Star Wars currently seems to be isn't really for me. And it's a bit of a bummer, but that's okay. It's, I'll still watch it. But I'm not putting the same emotional weight on it that I used to. And that was kind of how I've been feeling for a while. I've watched all of the Disney Plus shows, or the live action ones. I'm very behind on all the animated stuff. But and with the live action shows, I have enjoyed aspects of them and usually left each season of those shows feeling a little empty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm bringing into Andor, a show that, against all odds, I seem to be actually pretty excited to watch and talk about.
Yeah, I mean, the headline story around Andor is the guy who wrote and directed Michael Clayton is making a Star Wars show, right? Michael Clayton, probably one of my favorite films of all time.
It's a great movie. It's a really great movie.
Yeah, and so, and not only that, but the guy who I'm referring to, of course, is Tony Gilroy. And he's been responsible for many of my favorite films. Legendary in Hollywood as like a script doctor and knows how to refashion and save things and make them into a good story, which is what we're going to talk about a little bit for Rogue One. But he also worked on Rogue One and famously basically took that film over and kind of ghost directed the movie. He is not a credited director on Rogue
One. He's a credited writer.
But he's a credited screenwriter. And that is a shocking fact when you consider the fact that he did not start working on the movie until after the director's cut was complete. So in order to get screenplay credit, if you are not one of the original writers, you need to have written over 50% of the script. And so he got screenplay credit, apparently easily won, according to him on an interview that he gave.
And have you listened to that interview on Brian Koppelman's podcast? It's well worth listening to.
100%. He gave an interview to Brian Koppelman's The Moment podcast where he said, you know, probably like 8 to 10 sentences about the making of Rogue One. And I have been scrutinizing those sentences for years. So anyway, he was responsible for Rogue One. And a lot of people love Rogue One. And I actually really enjoyed Rogue One as well. But for me, everything after The Last Jedi has made me feel like this universe is not for me anymore, for the reasons that you described. Because it's, and you actually put it really well in one of your videos, the last video that you made about Star Wars, which is that it feels, the franchise feels more like it's interested in replaying its greatest hits over and over forever, to the extent that they're not even willing to hire new actors to play younger versions of the iconic characters, right? Like, at least with that, you would be kind of breathing new life into it in some way, you know? And kind of, oh, interesting, a new actor's take on a classic character. But instead, they're just kind of resurrecting these old characters over and over again using CG. And with Mandalorian, I'll just say I watched the first few episodes of Mandalorian and I quickly concluded it's not for me. Like, it's just kind of, hey, a cool Star Wars related thing that we saw, you know, for me, that was my perception. I know lots of people love Mandalorian and I don't want to like impugn the artistic quality of Mandalorian, but it just wasn't a show that I enjoyed.
Hey, I've seen every episode and I have mixed feelings.
Yeah.
There are episodes that I loved and there are ones that I did not enjoy very much at all. So yeah, it's current Star Wars, especially like this television era of Star Wars,
yeah,
is kind of is it, it's a complicated subject, because so much of this just is about like how you feel about constantly returning to the past and, you know, living in this world of nostalgia and like and wondering like how much like genuine emotional satisfaction can you get out of stories that seem to largely exist to fill in minor gaps in this fictional chronology of the universe. And like again, like the Obi-Wan Kenobi show, there was stuff in there that I genuinely liked. And at the end of the show, I walked away thinking, I think this was sort of pointless mm-hmm. overall, because there's so little to actually accomplish with mm-hmm. these characters in this gap of time, knowing where they have to begin and end. And especially the thing that I always come back to is Star Wars has originally existed as a big budget live action property. And there are Star Wars books and Star Wars comics and Star Wars animated shows. But the most important parts of Star Wars, the ones that are that play to like the widest audience by far, are live action Star Wars. And to me, the choices about what stories they're going to tell as an expensive live action movie/show, as opposed to being a comic book miniseries or a novel or something like that, that speaks volumes. And almost all of the live action Star Wars in the past few years, I have thought this could have just been a comic book series.
Mm-hmm.
Like why was this the one that warranted spending all that money and hiring this incredible cast and putting all your resources into this story?
Yeah. I think for me, it comes down to a few things. And we don't want to spend a lot of time rehashing our Star Wars universe grievances during this episode, but I think it's just important to know like what context we are. Like, we want you to know what our personal context is coming into a show like Andor.
Right. So if you hate everything that we've said so far, yeah, maybe the show isn't for you.
Maybe this podcast isn't for you. Right. Exactly. Right. And so I think that for me, it seemed like a lot of the stuff that was being done was fundamentally misunderstood why we enjoyed the things that we enjoyed from the original trilogy, right? Things like I did the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs, or the ship did the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs. And it's like, well, what if we actually showed the Kessel Run? It's like, it's actually kind of cooler in some ways if I don't see it, you know, like if I could just imagine what that even means. Or how did the Millennium Falcon get one in a dice game, or, you know, like all these kinds of things that like, where honestly what was shown that kind of led up to these moments that we saw in the original trilogy don't give those moments any more thematic or emotional weight. And that's ideally what you want when you're doing a prequel, right? When you're creating a prequel, you want to recontextualize everything that you've already seen and be like, ooh, I didn't know that that was the background. And that's what they attempted to do with the prequel trilogy and with something like Solo, A Star Wars Story, right? But they often chose not very interesting answers, in my opinion, to those questions that you might have had. And we will talk shortly about whether Rogue One does the same thing or not. But despite that kind of distaste for that kind of storytelling, what is interesting to me about Andor is it's created by somebody who's enormously talented at character-driven storytelling and by an outsider. Like, this person, Tony Gilroy, has publicly said he does not revere Star Wars in any way. And often that's where some of the most interesting stories come from, is like outsiders who take nothing for granted and for which nothing is sacred and for which they can experiment with, say, having a show that doesn't have any lightsabers or something, you know, as an example, right?
Someone who does not care about delivering fan service at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing, because as much as there are episodes and things in The Mandalorian that I enjoy a lot, so much of that show feels to me like Jon Favreau just loves Boba Fett and wants to play with his toys. And like, it feels very much like the sort of like, oh, a kid who watched Empire Strikes Back over and over and over again, and then bought all the Bounty Hunter action figures, and then just is like, you know, playing in their bedroom with them. And I'm like, that's fine. I see the appeal. I enjoy it sometimes, but that's not really what I'm coming to Star Wars for.
Yeah, and I think the biggest weakness, as far as I can tell, is that a lot of what Star Wars has done is rehash visuals and ideas that we've already seen. It's trying to evoke feelings in you that you had when you were a child. And like, oh, I remember when I saw this thing. And so we're going to show you a thing that looks like it, or that is similar to that thing, and that maybe explains how that thing came to be and so on. It's huge universe. That was one of the greatest things about Star Wars, is like when you look at the background, it's like, oh, all these little alien creatures. And like, I wonder what their home worlds are like. And I wonder what their stories are like. And that's what I've always wanted in a Star Wars extended universe, is explore these other things that they didn't have time for in the movies. And we are hoping that Andor will accomplish that. I will say, as of this recording, I have seen the first three episodes. And I tweeted about them recently, and I am very excited about doing this podcast with you, Patrick Willems. I think we're going to have some really great combos about it. So,
and David Chen, I have not seen any episodes yet, but based on your reaction, with no spoilers, I know nothing about it. Based on your take and takes from other friends of mine, I'm genuinely excited for this show.
So episodes of Andor are going to debut on Wednesdays, and we are going to try to have a new episode of this podcast covering Andor by the Thursday evening of that's following that week's episode. So just letting you know what the schedule is. And of course, if you're a Decoding TV paid member, we're going to try to get you access to those episodes earlier than everyone else. But anyway, all that said, that's our background with Star Wars. Patrick has seen basically every single Star Wars thing live action since Rise of Skywalker. I have not. We're both going to come into Andor with high expectations and high hopes, and we hope you're going to join us for the journey.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So all that said, why don't we dive into our conversation about Rogue One?
Let's talk about it.
State your name for the record.
Jyn Erso.
Forgery of Imperial documents. Possession of stolen property. Aggravated assault. Resisting arrest.
On your own from the age of 15. Reckless, aggressive, and undisciplined.
This is a rebellion, isn't it? I rebel.
That was from the very first teaser trailer of Rogue One. And I think it hints at some challenges that the movie had, in that virtually none of the dialogue or shots in that trailer ended up in the final film. Now, I tweeted about this earlier, and somebody corrected me via DM and said that something that Gareth Edwards, the director of Rogue One, liked to do is shoot a bunch of footage that would just go into the trailer. So just because it's in the trailer and not in the final film does not necessarily mean that there were problems with the production of this movie. But there were problems with the production of this movie, because there's major there's like some like little character moments that aren't in the final film, but there's also major action sequences.
There are fully completed VFX shots in that trailer. Where it's not just that the shots aren't in the final movie, the scene that they seem to exist in isn't in the final movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a troubled production. I mean, a thing that I was just thinking about when you were earlier when you were talking about Tony Gilroy coming in, like after the director's cut was completed, writing a ton of new stuff, enough to get a writing credit. Is this kind of like just a better case scenario of what happened with Justice League? It's almost exactly the same thing of a writer-director coming in after a director's cut was done. Obviously, in that case, not working with the director. In this case, Gareth Edwards, you know, seems much more positive about the final, the theatrical cut. But then rewriting enough new material to get a co-writing credit and then potentially directing a lot of reshoots themselves.
I think the biggest difference is that obviously the Justice League situation was cut short because of personal tragedy in Zack Snyder's life.
Right.
And I don't think he had completed a director's cut, which is a thing that would become a point of much contention.
According to, like, I think that recent Rolling Stone article, he had presented like a 2-hour and 40-minute cut to Warner Brothers. But I'm not saying they're one to one, but they're fairly close. It just in terms of like the credits and like the, you know, I guess the status of the new person coming in to like rework the movie. And this is was obviously just better received. I don't see anyone out there screaming about releasing the Edwards cut.
The Edwards cut, right. Although I think Ben Mendelsohn at least has confirmed that there is a drastically different cut of this movie that exists.
Very curious.
I know. I would have loved to. I would love to know the behind the scenes on this. We do have a few tidbits, though, right? From Tony Gilroy giving an interview to Brian Koppelman's The Moment podcast, where he says, "Quote: I've never been interested in Star Wars ever, so I had no reverence for it whatsoever. I was unafraid about that, and they were in such a swamp. They were in so much terrible, terrible trouble that all you could do was improve their position." End quote. So
he doesn't mince words.
To be fair, this was like years after the movie had come out. And what was interesting about the movie coming out, also another big difference, Patrick, as you indicated, is Gareth Edwards was game in all of the promotion for the movie. Like he was presented as the director of the movie. Like he was very positive. He played ball, basically. Like it was very like professional. Like he wasn't like, you know, there's some directors that come out. They're like, oh, they took control away from me. He was not like that at all. He was also, very like, yeah.
Gareth Edwards is he might have written Monsters, his first movie, but he's never generally been like a writer director. I think like he seemed, based on just interviews and stuff like that, it seems like he was like pretty open to collaborating with Gilroy to like just improve the story. Because like a lot of writers worked on this movie. Like it started, John Knoll had the idea like a decade earlier. And then like Gary Whitta wrote it. And then Chris Weitz, who actually has a final screenplay, wrote it, a final screenplay credit. And then like apparently, I think before Gilroy, like even like Chris McQuarrie like did a pass on it. Like so many people touched the script for this movie.
Yeah. And in some of the footage, you see kind of glimpses of sequences that were entirely shot that got cut, and it's just all very intriguing, you know, because it usually doesn't happen this drastically on this high profile of a film, and it's rare. Justice League is a great example. This is another example of like the movie's done, the execs think it's not in good shape, they bring someone in to basically ghost direct the movie and shepherd it to its completion.
And this was one of those things where this was in the era when Disney had promised there will be a new Star Wars movie in theaters every Christmas. Mm-hmm. And so they had that release date. And I will say this, I was thinking about this while rewatching the movie last night. It's really brought me back to what felt like this really kind of wonderful time, really, of 3 years, 2015 through 2017, where it was like, oh man, it'll be our nice Christmas tradition go to see like a Star Wars movie at Christmas each year, and it happens once a year, and it's like the big Christmas movie, mm-hmm. and it's really fun. And then so quickly, Disney is just like, yeah, what if we release Solo 6 months after the last one? And granted, I don't think everyone would have loved that movie if they'd waited a year, but right away, it was just like, You had this nice tradition that everyone was into, and like, why did you mess it up so fast?
Mm-hmm. I do think that timelines were a big part of the making of this movie, but you had three movies. Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, which I think came out before Last Jedi, I believe.
Yeah, right? Yeah. 2015, but, Force Awakens, 16, Rogue One, 17, yeah. Last Jedi.
Okay, but you have Rogue One, you have Rise of Skywalker, and you have Solo, Star Wars Story. Each one of those films had a troubled production. In fact, each one of those films basically had a different director than the one who ended up completing the film, if I recall correctly. Right?
Yes, that is true.
Colin Trevorrow was supposed to be Rise of Skywalker, right? So,
I mean, he wrote a whole script, was getting started on casting. That was pretty far along.
Who's to say what caused all this turmoil and trouble? A lot of people pin the blame on Kathleen Kennedy. I don't think we know enough about the machinations of Disney as a company to really make that conclusion. But I think it is very obvious that like each one of those movies was had a troubled production. And that's evident in scenes in the trailer not making it to the final film, tonal imbalances, plot lines, and character arcs that feel like heavily abridged or cut short. And it's unfortunate that that is kind of the current legacy of the Star Wars live action films. But all that said, that's all the lead up to this, right? And I think it's important to cover that because that will inform some of our conversation about the movie is like, what happened with this character? And why was this character, you know, and why is this character, why do they like each other now all of a sudden, you know, and that it will explain some of those inconsistencies is that like
yes.
Tony Gilroy came in after the movie is done. And also really interestingly spoke about the troubled production on this podcast with Brian Koppelman and Disney still hired him to come back to Andor. So clearly they were like, this guy has the goods. Like
that's what was really funny is I was reading an interview with him last night and I think this might've been maybe around when Rogue One came out, but he was asked if he had any interest in returning to Star Wars? And he's like, nope.
Absolutely not. So
no interest at all. That was a work for hire thing. I did it and I have no intention of returning. And then you skip ahead. I was reading the New York Times interview that came out with him like a day or two ago. And he seemed like so excited about it. He's like, I have worked as hard and put like as much of myself into this as I have on literally anything I've ever done. He's like, I am so proud of this.
Wow.
And his thing, he's just like, look, I don't care about fan service. I don't care that much about Star Wars. It's just that this is this universe is like this huge tapestry where you can tell a million stories. And he's like, you know, there was room for the story that I wanted to tell. And again, he keeps saying stuff that gets me excited.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. And so anyway, I say all that because typically the making of these movies is like under lock and key. There's like stories that leak out, but like the fact that he went on record and was like, the movie was in bad shape and I came in and saved it. Like people at places like Disney generally don't like that. But the fact that he said that publicly, it was written up in a bunch of places. They hired him back. It's like, they know this guy is enormously talented, right? Like, they would only do that if they're like, this guy can do something that no one else can do.
Right.
And I believe that's true. I think Tony Gilroy is enormously talented. And I hope he gets a chance to flex his muscles more in the Star Wars universe. So, anyway. Okay. All that said, that's all the hullabaloo behind the movie.
But he is not the director of Rogue One.
That's true. Not the credited director. But all that said, Patrick Williams, let's start by talking about overall thoughts on Rogue One. And then we can, and then I want to highlight like specific scenes and moments. Maybe we can go through the movie a little bit chronologically, but yeah.
Yeah. So Rogue One is a movie that I like with a lot of qualifiers, because it's a movie that I think has so many like genuinely fantastic elements to it, and like some really exciting filmmaking. And the script never fully clicks together for me. And so I find it very frustrating, I think, because I can see the, like, if I squint and cock my head to the side, I can see the like truly great movie that I think it could be. And there's just, because it has a really cool premise, as much as it is a movie that's basically built around like, oh, well, it's 2 hours to explain one line of dialogue in A New Hope. Like, that aside, like, diving into like the rebellion pre Luke Skywalker, and we've talked about Gilroy so much, but Gareth Edwards' like decision, which absolutely makes it through to the final product, of shooting this, as he said in a million interviews, like a war movie, but basically like, you know, the word wars is in the title, and but this is the first time that you've actually had like messy shootouts in like crowded city streets where
like what seems like trench warfare, basically, with the Scarif closing,
exactly,
action set piece,
that kind of stuff. Like the sequence that I always come back to is the one on Jeddah, where you've got like, it actually feels like, oh, an occupied city by like, mm-hmm, you know, a colonial army, and you've got like children crying in the middle of like a battle with just like buildings blowing up. You actually like the rebels feel more like, or at least like Saw Gerrera's group feels more like terrorists than they're generally portrayed as. And I think that's like it brings a new cinematic language and like visual vocabulary to Star Wars, which I think is like actually exciting. Obviously, we all love Greg Fraser as a cinematographer, and Greg Fraser's visual approach for this movie, I think, is so important, because like that basically when they decided to like launch the Disney Plus shows with The Mandalorian, they just went, just get him back and make them all look like Rogue One. Rogue One is just how like we want all our Star Wars TV to look now. And I think like that's a lot, like even like the way it's lit with like much like the lighting is so off, like there's like these dimly lit rooms that it feels like so naturalistic. I think that's all really, really exciting. The cast is amazing. A lot of fun characters. I think I just wish like, and I maybe it was in way worse shape before Gilroy came on, but there's just a lot of stories.
I'm told it was in terrible, terrible shape, and that you could only improve their position better.
I have heard this once or twice before. I can't remember where, but there's still just story elements that don't click together for me like I want them to. Like I'm never as emotionally engaged as I want to be. And oh, also by the way, CGI Peter Cushing always sucks, they should stop doing that forever. They won't, but every time he's on screen, it kind of kills whatever scene it is for me.
Yeah,
so
just hire a different actor. I am begging you guys.
Like, I mean, in that case, he doesn't even have to be in the movie. It's one of those things. Like okay. Can I make two giant notes for Rogue One right now if I'm a studio executive and I'm looking at the script? And maybe the fans will get a little bit less excited, but I don't care about the fans. Take Tarkin out of the movie. Just have another, like some other, like give Krennic some other boss who's not a distracting CGI dead person. Also, take Darth Vader out of the movie. I think
much
Vader
more controversial.
It is. I genuinely, as much like the final Vader hallway scene, I'm like, that's a fun cut scene in a video game. The story is basically over at that point. No, none of the of the characters who are actually who the story is about are in that scene at all. It's just there just to get the fans all riled up, and then it goes straight into CGI young Carrie Fisher, which also sucks. Yes. And it also seems dumb because you have Vader be like fighting these guys, and he's like, "Ah, you just slipped out of my like through my fingers." And then immediately they get on the blockade runner, and we know, oh, like 10 minutes later, he just catches up and gets on that ship. It just
Patrick, how will you know exactly how Vader ended up in the ship in episode 4 unless they explain it to you visually at the end of this film?
It's that. That's that ending with the with the just indulgent, like, let's show Darth Vader being a badass, even though it has no bearing on the story, going into creepy CGI Princess Leia. That is like, I look at that, and I'm like, oh, that is just a sign of what Star Wars was to become.
We didn't know what it was going to become later, right? But yeah. it's. I would agree that that is like pure fan servicey stuff that does not really serve the themes and story of this film, right? And it's just like connective tissue, you know. But hey, it's like the Nick Fury walking in at the end of Iron Man, you know. It's like, but that was confined to a post credit sequence. This is actually like part of the movie, right?
It was, and also that Nick Fury thing was actually like really like laying the groundwork for stuff to come, also introducing a new character. This is just
it's the thing you know from before,
to quote a video that I made myself several years ago, this, like, the thing with Darth Vader at the end, it feels like when they just do like an HD remake of an old video game where it's like, oh, it's the game that you love, but now the graphics are better.
Yeah
It's like okay, cool, you have the technology to make Darth Vader like more of a badass than they could in the 70s. Congrats. Anyway,
let me share some of my thoughts, overall thoughts, okay, on Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. I remember feeling very similar to you when I watched it the first time, you know, which is that there are a lot of shortcomings with the script, and kind of I don't feel like I really know any of these characters, and they don't really have much time to hang out and spend with each other and get to know each other, really. Some of the arcs, the character arcs, don't really work super well or feel pretty rushed. It feels like there's just whole scenes or sequences missing from the movie. And I'll mention a couple of them in the next few minutes. But freed from my expectations of all that, rewatching it again, I had a great time. And here are some amazing things about Rogue One. First of all, it's beautiful. This is one of the best looking Star Wars films ever.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just the way. Yeah.
David, keep being positive, because I ended up getting more negative than I wanted to.
Yeah.
Mostly just about the end of the movie. So like you swing it back in the other direction.
There's so many cool visuals and just your there's so many places you're going. Ring of Khafrin, Jedha, Wobani, Yavin 4, like all these places, and they all look Star Wars, but they all look really different too. And there's one, I don't remember which one, I think it's Yavin, that has like that statue that's, or maybe it's Jedha that has that statue that's like tipped over. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, okay. So, well, I mean, Yavin is just the one from A New Hope again. That's the one familiar planet. But no, Jedha has, because like the thing with
Jedha has that statue that's like,
right, like, because that was like a place almost like a holy planet of where like that's a statue of like a Jedi Knight,
right. And you can imagine, like, it's just like, wow, that's such a cool idea of this thing that's been tipped over and now it's like half covered in dirt. Like, you get a sense of the history of that place,
mean,
right?
This is my thing. I mean, considering that like so much of Star Wars, especially stuff that J.J. Abrams did, was, well, Star Wars started on a desert planet, so what if we just had all desert planets all the time? And so it's just everything just looks like Tatooine. And Mandalorian does that a lot, and also just goes to Tatooine. And here I'm like, they have one desert planet in this movie, and yet it's a desert planet that has like a twist to it. that has this new element and feels like a new place. And I'm like, there is what you're saying, like the attention to detail and like the imagination put into like making distinct new places. I want to shout out the place where we meet Cassie and Andor, which is like, seems like this sort of like space station thing of like two places that are like, like one's like flipped upside down. They like connect in the middle. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. It's the Ring of Khafrin trading outpost.
Yes. It looks amazing.
It's spectacular. Every location in the movie looks amazing and awe-inspiring and new. And it really kind of like expands the aperture of how you can view the Star Wars universe. So it's a beautiful, beautiful film. Some of the characters are really memorable. I would actually argue probably the most memorable character is played by Donnie Yen, Chira Imwe. He's amazing. And
he rules.
And I have, you know, watched many Donnie Yen movies. I've watched like the Ip Man movies and like a bunch of his other stuff. And when he comes in and makes a huge impression right from the get-go, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. And this is, I think this is, was like the first time we've seen an Asian American character in the Star Wars universe live action movies, I think. It might have been because this is before Last Jedi, right?
Yes.
So, and just seeing, I hate to use the cliche, but seeing someone that looked like me in the Star Wars universe, really powerful thing. But yeah, then now obviously there are more East Asian characters in the Star Wars universe now, and I'm glad about that as well. But
I mean,
go ahead.
I'm so sorry to cut you off. I was going to say a noteworthy thing about Rogue One is really in like the main group of the cast, Felicity Jones is the only white person.
Yeah, that's true. And it kind of goes to this idea of that this is like a ragtag group that's been assembled from all these different people and is trying to take down like a massive monolith. Other thing I like about the movie, Patrick Willems is, and we're going to spoil Rogue One. We already have, but we're going to spoil it even more, right?
They've all seen
it. Everyone dies at the end. And what an idea. What an idea. And that's something that Tony Gilroy said he really latched onto is everyone dies at the end. So the movie is ultimately about sacrifice and like, how do we get each of the character to a place where they're willing to sacrifice? Why would they want to sacrifice? And we can talk about how successful they were in that regard. But apparently there was like an earlier version of the script where Andor and Jyn Erso survive. And I have to imagine that the temptation from Disney's perspective for these characters to survive is massive. It's like, I want to have future spinoffs of them. I want to make action figures of them. I want them to be in future films like, you know, Rise of Skywalker or whatever. And it's like, but they shut the door on most of that when they had them killed. Now, obviously, we're getting an Andor prequel series, but there's no Jyn Erso in the future from this point forward. And that's a bold move. And I admire that a lot.
And apparently, they never even shot the other ending. Like what I was reading about was that Edwards just assumed that they wouldn't let them kill everyone off.
Yeah.
And then Disney was like, oh, no. Or I shouldn't say... The thing with Disney is like, you know, Lucasfilm is really kind of its own company within Disney. So it's really like the Lucasfilm people who are like making these decisions. But they were like, no, we like the dark ending. Let's do it. And so that was the thing that like Gilroy didn't change that or anything. That was always the ending, like from like what they originally shot, which I think is cool. That's like, I think it's one of the best things about the movie.
It's also like really beautifully done too. You know, I was watching the movie with my wife. She was weeping at the end when they're going down the elevator and they're kind of in each other's arms and they know that they're about to die. And then they go to the beach and they kind of like celebrate the fact that they made a contribution to this fight. It's very beautifully done. It's very emotional. The visuals are great. Like, and so.
And you also get the thing with Krennic, on the planet also just realizing that he's just utterly disposable and that they just even that they're using his own weapon and he's just like a casualty.
Yeah, pretty cold-blooded of the Empire, you know, and that's the thing, is at the end of the day, the question for a movie like Rogue One is, does this movie improve your understanding of Star Wars, right? Is your viewing of Star Wars Episode 4 richer having seen Rogue One? And I think to some degree the answer is yes, right? Because A, you understand that there's a reason why it's so easy to destroy the Death Star, you know, which has been a joke for a long time, but now there's an actual legitimate reason. Don't know why they built it kind of the same way two times, but, you know, let's put that aside.
Well, they had to destroy it a different way the second time.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. That's true. But it's like still seemed pretty easy in Return of the Jedi. I'm just going to put that out there.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it wasn't even finished yet. They, you know, way easier to access.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole thing of why the whole thing of building a second Death Star is a problem that I've had with Return of the Jedi for a very long time.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
That's a conversation.
I will say it makes Star Wars Episode 4 better, and it makes Star Wars Episode 6 worse.
Yes.
But you also get a sense of why that person did it that way, and like that person's background. You know, I'm talking about Galen Erso, and also all the sacrifice it took to get the plans, right? And how difficult every step of this process must have been. So that ultimately when Luke destroys that thing in Episode 4, it is in some ways more satisfying. It is like the completion of an arc that begins in Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think like they did a decent job when it comes to delivering a good prequel, right? After watching Better Call Saul, the prequel series to Breaking Bad, I have like whole new criteria for what makes for a good prequel. And it's really just two criteria. Number one, introduce new characters or characters that we didn't know that we can get invested in. If it's just existing characters, then we already know what's going to happen to them. Like, I want new characters that we don't know what's going to happen to them, so that we don't, you know, there's some suspense there. But yeah, and that certainly this movie does that. There's a bunch of new characters that I care about and I think are cool. And then also, does it make the later thing more interesting? And I think this one does that as well. So that's kind of the case for Rogue One, Patrick, right? A lot of good stuff in this movie, I think, worth considering.
Well, to like go off of what you were just saying, the thing that I kind of like, that's a little bit of a sticking point with me always with Rogue One is, on the one hand, yes, I think what this movie does actually like strengthen the movie that comes next chronologically. It does like it functions as a good prequel in terms of like, oh yes, like the new information it gives us about the larger story does actually, it's a good, healthy contribution that strengthens the overall thing. Also, you know, as I said before, the new cinematic way it portrays things that are familiar to us, also very exciting. The thing that I kind of butt up against is, but okay, outside of it, like being a prequel to Episode 4, as just a standalone movie, like how good is it as a standalone movie? Because like, and I think, you know, you alluded to some of this earlier when you said that, you know, it feels like there are chunks of the movie missing. And a thing that I always run into, I'm just like, man, it feels like initially we don't know Jyn Erso that well if she's ostensibly the lead of the movie. And then it feels like she jumps through several steps in like her character arc that I guess happen off screen. And I'm just like that's the thing. Like there's so much like good stuff in this movie. Its contributions to like Star Wars mythos are great, but I'm just like, man, other than having good actors, I wish I was more invested in like almost any of these characters and their relationships with each other. And
let's dive into some specific scenes, right?
Yeah.
So I'm gonna do a pretty quick speed run through the movie right now. The movie opens on Erso's homeworld, I guess, where he's living out his days farming peacefully. And I just want to say, like, amazing evocative opening. No big Star Wars fanfare. And you kind of see, like, the outline of this planet. And then you see, like, what looks like rings of a planet with a beam of light shooting through it. And it's just like, wow, like you're kind of like, I think I know what that is. I think that's like rings of, and then you kind of need to spend time figuring out. It's like a very beautiful, mysterious, evocative opening. Krennic, who's played by Ben Mendelsohn, awesome villain, great space cape.
He's so good. The cape rules, but also having a villain who is just kind of like a middle manager, who's not like, you know, the head of the Empire, who's just a guy who works for the Empire, who's like in charge of like getting a project finished on time. It's a fantastic choice.
I agree. He lands on the planet. The main stakes of the movie are set up where he's like, I need you to come back. Galen Erso's wife, Lyra, gets murdered or killed, you know, defending herself, whatever you want to call it. And then Jyn Erso runs away, hides out in a predetermined hiding position. And then Saw Gerrera comes, is like, let's go. We've got a long journey ahead. Cut to decades later, Jyn Erso is a grown woman in prison. That's when we meet Andor at a separate location at the Ring of Khafrin trading outpost. Very Blade Runner vibes. And we meet Cassian Andor, played by Diego Luna. That's the guy from the show that we're going to be covering, Patrick Willems. And he meets an informant named Tivik, who is about to go leave and go back to Jeddah. And he's like, some guy named Galen Erso sent this Imperial pilot who's defecting. And then some stormtroopers happen upon them. And then Andor just straight up cold-blooded murders the two stormtroopers and his informant. A critical moment to pay attention to, especially as we get into the Andor series. But yeah, the way that Andor plays that scene, he is... I don't think there's no regret. He's not like a complete sociopath, but he clearly is like... I don't think this is the first time he's done something like this, is kind of my sense.
Right. And also, I think part of it is because like the guy has like a messed up leg or something. Or basically, like, can't get... Like, he knows that the guy is going to slow him down. And like, if he tries to take him with...
Possibly get them all caught and in trouble. Right?
Exactly. So it's just like, it's a like, you know, necessary casualty for the greater good that he's fighting for. I mean, that scene is so important just in terms of like part of the movie's mission statement, which is let's portray the rebellion in like, you know, not as just like a pure beacon of light in the galaxy. It's like, no, this is complicated and messy. There are like, you know, moral shades of gray going on. Not everyone is as like, you know, as innocent as old Luke Skywalker is when he joins. I think that's really, really important. My beef with this stretch of the movie is that I think the opening is great and setting up Jyn as like, okay, her father is taken by the Empire to work for them. Her mother is killed. She goes into hiding, and then weird Forrest Whitaker comes and like pulls her out and is like, I will protect you. My issue here is that it jumps around to so many character introductions that these characters are all separated that I feel like that, especially on this viewing, I was thinking I would really like to know a bit more about who Jyn is now and what is her life and what is she doing and what are her priorities and how does she feel about everything. And even though she is the lead character of the movie, she's just one of many characters introduced here. And to the point where I'm thinking, like, could they have just combined the Cassian scene with maybe then he's going to get her and they're at the same place and like bring them together earlier on to like establish like mm-hmm. their relationship more. I think the movie really skips over a lot of like characterization with Jyn that
for sure. But I don't know that I agree that the issues happen in the first act of the movie. We're just introducing people. I think act one is completely fine in my opinion. It's act two where I think most of the problems are.
Okay.
When it comes to the introductions, there is some characterization of Jyn when basically the rebels go to extract her and she kind of completely messes them up and then like tries to escape before K2SO takes her out.
Right.
That kind of gives you a sense of like who she is, you know, but we're not hanging with her. Right. And in fact, I think one of the biggest problems of the movie is later on. Right. Okay. So she gets captured. They're like, hey, you got to go meet Saw Gerrera. And you got to figure out what's going on with this pilot, and then we got to get to your dad. And then Saw Gerrera and her have this very intense meeting where she's like, you know, the last time I saw you, you were 16. And, you know, and she's like, you left me with a blaster and nothing else in a hole. And I'm like, wait, was this the hole from the first scene? No, it's a different hole. And it, basically, there's this whole sequence of events that happened between these two characters that we never see in the movie.
Right.
And it's very odd because we saw this other, we saw this first flashback to their, when she was a kid, and then we meet her much later. And then there's all the stuff that's happened between them that we don't even know about. And in fact, the only thing that's alluded to is when that relationship ended, mm-hmm. which we also don't see. So it's just like, it's really weird to communicate, to have the flashback and then communicate the rest of that via dialogue,
you know, especially because when he shows up, you know, at the end of the cold open at the beginning,
yeah,
you think, oh, then these two are going to be together when we see them.
Yeah.
And then instead they only see each other. They're only together on screen once in the entire rest of the movie. And it's the last time they ever meet.
Yeah. It's just very odd.
I mean, yeah. This is part of my thing where, again, there's a lot of cool stuff happening when they're introducing Bodhi, the pilot, plays by Riz Ahmed, who's like going to Jeddah to meet with Saw Gerrera. And there's the whole thing where there's like the weird tentacle creature that like sticks a tentacle in his ear to like read his mind and stuff like that. And again, I'm not saying I have like the immediate fix here, but it's jumping around to so many different characters here that I feel like Jin and what she wants get kind of pushed to the background a little bit, yeah. to the point where even like when Cassian brings her to see Saw Gerrera, for a while she's just kind of like hanging out in the background while other people are talking until she finally kind of like forces her way into the conversation. And I just... Despite her, hitting back some of the rebels who like pick her up from the prison transport early on, she's very passive for a while, kind of just getting shuffled to different places by other people. It takes a while for her to like be like making choices and driving the story forward. And I get like all I'm really saying is I just, because she is the protagonist, I wish the movie treated her as a bit more of a protagonist instead of just like one of a big tapestry of characters.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But again, I don't have a problem with like meeting so many characters. I have a problem with Jin's arc being so shortened, and I have a problem with Saw Gerrera's arc being so shortened. So maybe I am saying the same thing as you, but I think we have similar issues with the movie. So anyway, Jin Erso's captured. They go to, you know, the Rebel Alliance briefs her, and they go to Jeddah. One of the things that I think is great about this movie is what happens to the Bodhi character. He's clearly like an Imperial defector, and Riz Ahmed is like obviously a great actor, and I believe him from the start that he's like an Imperial defector. And then when Saw Gerrera subjects him to basically mental torture and possibly mental annihilation, the idea of Saw as a zealot, I think, or they're extremist, I think, is the term that's used, right? And you use the word terrorist. I think that's also accurate. I like the idea of, hey, rebellions are actually messy. Like, you got Andor offing folks left and right, you know, including informants. You got Saw Gerrera on the other side, who is taking defectors and like destroying their brains, you know. And it's like, oh wow, this is maybe the alliance, the Rebel Alliance, is not really as good as we thought it was. And the idea that you can have these like little factions split off and arguing with each other is really cool. What's great about Rogue One is you get a sense of what Imperial occupation is like and what the world of Resistance might also be like. We see the Jedi, the city of Jeddah, and the temple, and we meet Chirrut Imwe and his buddy, and
Baze Malbus, you know, pay him the proper respect.
True enough. And they're like people who used to guard the temple, but now that the temple is fallen, they don't really have anything to do. And
you do also just get Donnie Yen beating up stormtroopers with a stick, which is
and it's a really cool, just a cool character in concept and execution. The idea of a guy who's like not a Jedi, force sensitive, blind, believes in the force. It's, again, it just helps to like fill out this world in a really fascinating way. Also, I got to say, I loved K2SO in this movie. Like, at this point, we've seen like funny droids in Star Wars for decades now and with varying degrees of success. But I laughed at almost every single line that K2SO said in this movie. I just thought he's basically like, in some ways, an audience surrogate, like just kind of saying what you might be thinking in a weird situation like this. So Alan Tudyk, I think, plays K2SO. He did an amazing job.
Yeah, they've managed to find a new, I guess, a new take on like the droid helper who goes along, you know, with the protagonist. Sorry, a British accented droid helper. Mm-hmm. And they've done a lot of those. And this is like a genuinely unique one. And wait, is he in Andor?
I'm sure I can't comment one way or the other.
Actually, my guess is he'll show up in Andor season 2.
Mm-hmm. We'll see. So anyway, they go to the city and there's a massive firefight. Firefight's like pretty well done. You know, it's like a pretty good action scene.
I mean, it's chaotic and messy and like grungy in a way that Star Wars firefights aren't.
So then, like, she finally goes and meets Saw Gerrera, and they have the interactions that we discussed. And, yeah, I mean, what I love about the Saw Gerrera character, despite the fact that I feel we didn't learn enough about him, like, we know so little about what has happened in his life. But first of all, like, the visual is amazing. Like, he's, like, basically a cyborg at this point.
Yeah.
He has, like, robotic body parts. He needs to breathe through a mask like Dennis Hopper in Blue Valentine. You know, like, he's all kinds of, like, stuff has happened to him, obviously. And so just like you can tell this guy has been through some terrible things, which I'm hoping we're going to see some of in Andor, you know, like to some degree, get a sense of that character more, because he is in the poster for Andor. So I'm like, I wonder what they're going to fill in with Saw Gerrera stuff. But the cool thing about Saw Gerrera, I think, is this idea of the guy has become basically completely unhinged. Like, he is... His mind no longer accepts reality. He's become a paranoid paranoid person living in seclusion and isolation, increasingly fueled by his paranoid fantasies, to the extent that he's like hurting people who might be wanting to help his cause. Basically, that's like a interesting idea for a character, you know. And I think it's for the most part well executed, but we just don't know so little about him. The guy gets like, I don't know, 20 lines in the whole movie, right? Like, we just know very little about him now.
And also a lot of, he's talking, we're trying to fill in the gaps about like him and Jin to be like, okay, so what happened like in all the time since he like came and rescued her from like the underground bunker?
Right. Yeah. And it's not like clearly laid out or anything like that. It's just like hinted at basically. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this to me is part of what gets a little bit muddled, because there's all this stuff with like the rebellion's relationship with him as this extremist that, like, you know, they're kind of on the outs with, and like his different approach to rebellion. But then you've also got the aspect of it of like his relationship with Jin and trying to fill in the stuff there. And so there's a lot going on with him in like a very limited amount of screen time.
Yeah. Yeah. But for the thing that I really like about that whole sequence is she views the message, and then
from Mads Mikkelsen, who we haven't mentioned yet.
From Mads Mikkelsen, who's like, hey, I'm going to get my revenge because I built in a weakness into the thing. And I think Felicity Jones, who plays Jyn Erso, just like acts her heart out in that scene where she's just kind of like in anguish and like collapses on the ground because... it's very powerful because it's her first time reconnecting with her father in a very long time. And to know that he not only thinks about her, but like has a plan for her, you know, in this way is, it kind of sells it for me, you know, in a way that I think is really important, because she's doing a lot of heavy lifting in that scene, because you really need that scene to land for the rest of the movie to work.
Right.
I think, you know, so, then, they decide to test the Death Star, and they're like, we don't need to destroy the whole planet. Let's just have a little sprinkling of Death Star juice on Jedha. They destroy Jedha City. The whole sequence is incredible, I think. And I really feel like you get a sense of I don't want to exaggerate too much, especially because Oppenheimer is going to come out next year. But like, I really feel like you get a sense of like, this must be what people who felt like they were testing the atomic bomb must have felt like when you see the destruction of Jeddah and just like the shockwave and the whole planet is like, it's not just like limited to a city and it's done. It's like the explosion lasts for minutes.
It
has a perverse beauty to it, you know,
yeah.
Like where you're, yeah.
Anyway. I mean, both with Jeddah and then especially when they fire the Death Star at Scarif at the end, it's like, it basically forms a mushroom cloud. Like the imagery is like very deliberately like an atom bomb blast. Yeah. Like that is what they're dealing with. It's like, oh, the Death Star for the Empire is basically, you know, them making the atomic bomb, them building their super weapon that can wipe out an entire civilization.
Yeah. And, but the way the sort of execution, cause it doesn't do exactly what an atom bomb would do. Right. Like, atom bomb doesn't like raise the ground up, you know, in the way that it does in the movie. And then there's a scene where you like see the Krennic and his goons looking at it from above, and they're talking about how beautiful it is. And it's also like disconnected from the chaos that's on the ground, and like cutting back and forth between those things is just a really effective editing and storytelling, I think.
Yeah, so, from Krennic and crew's perspective, like on the Death Star, they might as well be looking at like a beautiful moving abstract painting.
Exactly. Then they barely get away in time. You know, they've taken on Chirrut and Baze, right?
Saw dies in the explosion.
That was so weird to me. He's like, "Hey, I'm tired of running. Goodbye." And it's like, okay, what? Like, feels like you've taken great steps to stay alive, like, in the course of this, you know, like, he clearly has a whole, like, secret lair and everything, and he's just like, okay, you guys going on without me. And it's like,
I guess he can't run?
Why? No, he doesn't say, I can't run, I'm too weak. He's like, I'm tired of running. He's like, I'm tired of, like, being in hiding, I think he's saying. Right?
What you might think, now that they have just learned about this Death Star, that like, oh, suddenly like we could like, we have a chance at stopping this super weapon. You'd think that would, if anything, get him more invested in his cause instead of being like, you guys got it from here.
It's a bizarre decision. And I think it's just like, we need to figure out a way for Forrest Whitaker to not be in the rest of the movie because it's too many characters.
Right. And also wanting to give him a like stoically looking into the face of death, despite the fact that that's what the whole ending to the movie already is.
So right. That, like, why couldn't Forrest Whitaker have been on that beach with them? You know, doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense. Anyway, there is this sequence where they go find her dad. Right. And
David, we have to talk about the sequence because this is a real sticking point for me.
Yeah. This is probably like, this whole situation is probably the most challenging part of the movie, right?
Okay, just maybe. Yeah. Why
the setup is that Andor has been told by Rebel Command that he needs to kill Galen Erso, right? And so they're like, okay, let's go find Galen Erso. We just want to at least make sure he's cool. Like, and the story that they're telling Jyn Erso is like, we're going to extract him and bring him back, but in fact, they're just going there to kill him, right? So, and there's a pretty cool sequence where they kill him, and then Krennic brings all his guys out, and he's like, who of you was responsible for this leak? And, okay, fine, I'm just going to assume it's a group effort. You know, like, he's delightfully evil in the whole movie. And then he shoots all the people that aren't Galen Erso, and it's like, oh, that's really evil, too. Like, love everything Ben Mendelsohn's doing in the movie. And then Andor gets up there, and he's about to take the kill shot, but he's like, no, I can't do it. Why? We don't know. But it doesn't matter because Alliance bombs drop on the whole thing and kill Galen anyway.
Well yeah, because they send in a whole X-Wing fleet then just like blow up, like, you know, I guess the facility where they design the Death Star. So,
yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try to lay this out because I was thinking through it while I was watching the movie again last night, and I'm like, I don't entirely get this. So, the rebellion hears that they know who Galen Erso is, because he's like the head guy involved in like designing the Death Star, because he's like an engineering genius. They've heard that he sent a pilot to defect who apparently has like a message for Saw Gerrera. And they're like, oh, we want to know what's going on there. We want to know why this defector was sent by Galen Erso, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, well, the one way we could potentially get in with Saw Gerrera, because he's like a hard man to deal with, is if we can find Galen Erso's daughter, who he knows, who will maybe like put in a good word for us and like get him to talk to us. So that makes sense. What is the point of killing Galen Erso? Because I would have thought that what they would want is to extract him to get information about the super weapon from him. Like the whole point, like if they know that he sent this defector pilot to like mm-hmm. bring a secret message, wouldn't the rational thing to do be like, well, since he clearly is trying to work against the Empire, let's get him out and use his knowledge against them. What's the point of killing him? To do what they were doing with Cassian at the beginning, which is to show the rebellion in grayer shades of morality.
I don't think it's that much of a stretch, to be honest with you, Patrick, because I think the idea is maybe they're still refining the weapon. Maybe the weapon's not done yet.
Is that how they came up with the name Andor?
Maybe, yeah. Maybe they're going to have future super weapons that improve on this, that they're going to use Galen to help build. You know, like, it's not too much of a stretch to be, you know, it's like, you ever see Wind Talkers, you know? John Woo, Wind Talkers? And it's like the idea is like...
I never watched Wind Talkers. No one seemed to like it very much.
It's not a great movie, but the idea is that these Native Americans like carry this code with like important information, and that if their enemies ever threaten to capture them, like you must terminate the people who have the code in them so that you can protect the information, right? And so the idea is that he's critical to their efforts, so they want to kill him. That's not too much of a stretch for me to imagine. To me, I didn't think that's where you're going with this. I thought where you're going to go with this is like Jyn Erso's plot, because there is a scene earlier with Saw Gerrera where he's talking about how Imperial flags fly throughout the galaxy, and she says, it's not a problem if you don't look up, which is an awesome line. And she says, you know, the Alliance, all has ever brought me is pain. And you're like, oh yeah, I guess the Alliance has really made her life really hard. And you kind of get a sense of like why, you know, Galen working for the Alliance would be a problem. The Alliance then murders her dad in this scene, right? And then literally like two scenes later, she's kind of hanging out with the Alliance and being like, let's go and fight against the Empire.
She's not just hanging out with the Alliance. She has become their most passionate, dedicated member mm-hmm. in one scene. As in, like, she has gone from being like, is there swearing on this podcast, David?
Yeah, let's avoid it. Just say F it instead.
Okay. I should have checked ahead of time. So she's okay. So once we jump ahead to the present after the opening flashback, she's like, screw everything. I don't want to be involved in everything. I'm mad at the world. I don't want to join any side. I hate you all. Right? That's where she is.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And then as soon as she learns that her father is still alive and still loves her and is like plotting against the Empire to like help destroy their big weapon, then understandably she's like, I want to see my father again. I care about him. And but then also, like you said, he is killed by the rebellion. And so I get her having loyalty to her father, and like maybe wanting to, you know, carry out his wishes, but just the jump to her making passionate speeches, like at this round table, as in like it's all the leaders of the rebellion, people who we know are galactic senators. We've got Bail Organa, Jimmy Smits himself, at mm-hmm. this meeting. And then her, this girl who doesn't like them, who got brought in as like a prisoner like a day before, is there giving a speech about how rebellions are built on hope and we have to do this. Is again, I'm not opposed to the idea of this. I'm just like, we skipped
the execution. We skipped the whole reel, basically.
As in, she needed like another week of her life and other events to happen to get her to that point. And also, she should be madder at the rebellion for
killing her dad, who she has wanted to reunite with for years.
Well, again, this is my thing of like, I'm not trying to just script doctor the whole thing, but like, if the Empire killed her dad, and Cassian was not assigned to kill him, if they were trying to extract him, maybe, it would make a lot more sense to me.
Yeah,
that
it would make a lot more sense for her arc.
For what they're trying to do, and this is the thing. I'm just like, I see what they're trying to do. I see what the arcs are, and I'm just like, I wish it fit. I wish the pieces fit together more cleanly.
I agree. But she gives her motivational speech. She gets a bunch of rebels involved, and then everyone heads to Scarif. Now, Scarif
they steal a ship and do it. Yeah, off they steal the books. A ship.
And Scarif is like an awesome design for a planet. The idea of like a tropical planet with like imperial installations on it, because no one would, if you're in a tropical place, you would never build the stuff in the way that they do it, right? Like, so just to see that together in that juxtaposition is so fascinating.
You know what's brilliant about Scarif also? The Star Wars movies have always had a tradition of filming in places that are really unpleasant to film.
Yeah.
And here, finally, they were like, wait a second. What if we filmed this movie in, like, the nicest place in the world? We spent years in deserts and, like, Arctic landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
What if we went to the Bahamas and just chilled out?
It's a very simple setup for Scarif. It's just like, we got a shield gate. We got to bring it down. We got to beam the plans onto the ship. And that's... I love it when the stakes are simple. Everything looks amazing. I will say it doesn't really make any sense. Like, there's this idea of a shield gate. Really cool idea. Makes absolutely no sense, like, from an energy perspective. You know, like, how would you have enough energy to, like, cover an entire planet? You know, it doesn't make any... But it's like, what a cool idea of the shield gate that you need to, like...
I mean...
You cannot access the planet's surface except through this one tiny hole. You know, it's like, yeah.
I think it's a really smart move. I mean... The whole thing with Star Wars planets is like, I'm convinced every planet in Star Wars is really like the size of a city, because at every single time they'll arrive at a planet and just be like, well, the people we're looking for are somewhere on this planet. Can you imagine if someone came to Earth and was like, well, David Chen is somewhere on this planet, so let's just land at a random point, and then we'll run around, and we'll eventually find him. But, like, they're very small. Also, you know, there's sound in space here. Like, you know, nothing really makes sense. But I love the security idea of it, because, you know, they're storing their most top-secret files on this planet. So what if they made it so that they have – total control over every person who enters or leaves through one tiny little like entrance way. That's really smart.
Agreed. I mean, what I'm saying is like technologically probably impossible, but you know, really cool idea, you know, and it looks amazing. Right?
You know, it's all technologically impossible.
100%. But anyway, there's a big firefight and there's some amazing moments of the firefight. Okay. I'm going to list a few. Chirrut's last moments, right? Like, I'm one with the Force and the Force is with me. And he's like walking out there and then he dies in his friend's arms. And it's just, oh, heartbreaking. There's a moment when Riz Ahmed is trying to get this transmission to the Admiral up in the ship. And someone just throws a grenade and it like lands in his ship. And Riz Ahmed like looks at it for like a second and then it explodes. And he, you know, and then at that moment you realize like, holy crap, they are starting to actually off these characters left and right, which I did, you know, the whole movie you've been with these characters, none of them have died. And so you're like, oh, They're just going to be with us for the whole movie. But then they start dying one by one, and it is shocking and sad. And my brain is like processing, like, oh my gosh, who else is going to die in the rest of the film, right? Any specific moments from the battle you want to mention? I mean, there's also, of course, the Star Destroyer getting disabled. I don't think we've ever seen before. And then they push it into another Star Destroyer, which is incredible, right?
That might be my favorite, just because, like, I'm always a fan of when they introduce a new Star Wars ship that has a very specific function. And when they bring in the Hammerhead ship, which is smart. And it's the thing where, you know, Star Destroyers are so large. They're huge. They're so big. And the thing is, obviously, in space, you know, you're in the vacuum of space. You give a thing like some like inertia, some momentum, and it's going to keep moving that way. So it just kind of it's a good strategy. These Star Destroyers are right next to each other. What if you just kind of bump one enough so that it just crashes into the other one? It's like, it's such a, I mean, I hate to invoke controversial topics, but as someone who has always been very pro the light speed ramming in Last Jedi, because it was when I watched that in the theater, I was
the
like...
The Holdo maneuver.
When I watched that in the theater, I was like, oh my God, what? This is like, I never even thought that would be like it makes so much sense once you finally see it, and it's such a cool technique. And the same thing here, I'm just like, yeah, just kind of like gently like ramming one of their stationary like giant battleships into another, because they're in space and it will just move in that direction, and especially to then get it to crash through like the shield generator or whatever. That's just purely like them thinking about like, okay, how do we use the pieces in this world in new ways? That's a really clever one.
I loved all the dogfighting around the shield generator thing too. And the shield generator at one point like opens up and you see TIE fighters in the shield generator station come out of it. And it's like, oh my gosh. And it really brought back like the old feelings of watching original Star Wars with all the dogfights, but not fighting a Death Star for once.
It's,
you know,
true. I mean, there's two things I want to say here. My one, not even like a problem that I have with this big final set piece, but just a thing that holds it back from like being like one of the all time classic Star Wars battles for me, is just that we don't, as much as it's like fun to watch the dogfight, we don't know any of those characters who were up there. And so when it's cutting to like random people, random pilots, I'm just like, I mean, it's always been, every Star Wars opinion has to be a controversial one, but a problem I've always had with Return of the Jedi is the final Death Star battle is really cool, but of like the main three, like Luke, Han, and Leia, none of them are involved in it. Like Lando's there, but like we don't have one of our absolute core characters in that space battle, and so, and so kind of like here, it's like, you know, it's very fun to watch it. It's visualized and choreographed really well. The effects are great. The ship designs are great. I just wish there was like at least one character who we had some kind of emotional connection to up there flying around.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
That said, General Raddus, you know, the Mon Calamari guy is cool.
Yeah.
Oh, and actually, sorry. The other thing I was going to say, because we've kind of talked around it, but haven't like said it deliberately, because you were just talking about the thing with the TIE fighters coming out of the shield generator.
Yeah.
The thing that Gareth Edwards' greatest skill has always been finding unique ways to visually communicate a sense of scale.
Yes.
He did it with like his, you know, low budget debut film Monsters was all about that. I think it's the best part about his Godzilla movie, shooting like the whole thing from like a human's perspective, so that just like a foot coming down in the background has such weight to it and feels so immense. And the ways that he communicates scale throughout this movie, whether it's like shooting the Death Star from unique angles, whether it's showing a Star Destroyer like hovering inside the atmosphere on Jeddah, are seeing like the Death Star,
showing a Death Star eclipse a sun, you know?
Exactly. There's so many incredible visuals throughout this movie that are like that, where it's like, oh my God, he actually found a new way to shoot this, like the Star Wars thing that we've seen in like six movies before this. And throughout this, there's so many things like that. And like to the point where like, no matter how much Tony Gilroy did come in, and like change stuff around, you can still feel like Edward's fingerprints throughout this. And
yeah, and just a lot of moments of awe, you know, and that's what his movies inspire, is like awe in the light of like these massive structures or creatures, basically.
It's true. Right?
You know, the script at this point becomes very workmanlike, I would say, where everyone gets to have their final confrontation. You know, Krennic somehow makes it up to the thing at the same time as Jyn Erso, and they get to have a little final confrontation. And then Andor gets up there and he shoots Krennic, but then Krennic is alive so that he gets to be alive when...
Well, also, it seems Andor is dead, but then, oops, he's not dead.
He's not dead. Yeah, he fell what you thought would be a massive distance, but fortunately there was a little landing right there. And then, Krennic is alive to see his own creation turned upon himself, which is like another...
That's
again,
great.
Which I think it's great to show, like, there's no honor really amongst any of these people, right?
Yeah.
The Alliance, you know, is willing to murder their own, and so are the Empire. You know, they're kind of... Some might say they're different shades of the same kind of people, you know?
Oh.
Perhaps. We'll probably learn more about that in Andor. Anyway, so then they go to the beach. They have this big emotional moment. They don't like kiss or do anything romantic, which I think they hold each other, you know, and that's kind of beautiful. But I kind of like that there was no like romance or any weird thing that came out of nowhere.
Didn't have any time for that.
Yeah, they didn't have any time. And then the Darth Vader stuff you already talked about. I don't think we need to talk really about that anymore, but you know, we're coming to the end of our conversation. Patrick, any thoughts about this Scarif sequence or the movie as a whole as we wrap up here?
I think this part's all pretty cool and pretty effectively done. There are some parts where I do wonder, could we, like, for instance, Chirrut Imwe, Baze Malbus, you know, many people's favorite characters in the movie. I do wonder, like, could they have gotten some kind of arc that like maybe reaches its completion during mm-hmm. the sequence? You know, could there like would it make sense to have a thing? Cause like Chirrut is like such a believer in the Force and all of that. You know, he has his mantra that he repeats constantly. Like he's like the one person who cares about that. And everyone's like, that's a bunch of baloney. And like, I don't know, like would it have made sense to like maybe in his like dying moments, like have him actually like move something with the Force or something just to like, you know, just to pay off this thing that has been there throughout the whole movie. Cause like, again, these characters are great. I love them. They do feel fairly static throughout. They're just kind of there along for the ride doing their thing. And it would be nice to give at least a little bit of, like, you know, feel like they've been on some kind of emotional journey that you know, that's going somewhere. But
I think that's a good call out. I will say that every character gets a heroic death.
They do get a heroic death. And
the movie kind of takes time to like pause on every death to some degree.
It does.
And that's nice.
I do think Bodhi's death, Riz Ahmed's character, is the one that stands out the most to me just by feeling so unlike Star Wars. A guy who's like, he's
like mid-conversation. Basically.
He's mid-conversation and also feels like he's winning. Like he's on a high note.
And then
dies in like, look, Chirrut and Baze have actual like pretty heroic deaths.
Yeah.
Bodhi is just
Ditto K2SO even, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, K2SO yeah. really gets a heroic death.
Yeah.
Considering he's not technically alive, but Bodhi just gets he gets the unceremonious death, which the way he dies to me is the kind of thing like that's representative of the best of Rogue One, which is showing you Star Wars in a way you don't usually see it. Like, you don't see characters die like that in Star Wars. If characters die in Star Wars, it's because they get dramatically, like, impaled with a lightsaber and, mm-hmm. like, stare into their enemy's eyes as, like, the life leaves their body. They don't just die because, like, a grenade just bounces into,
just
like...
Yeah, bounced into the thing by accident, you know, maybe not even intentionally, right?
Right. That one really stands out because it feels so jarring and so far from what we usually expect. And I think it's really effective. And as much as I am always had to see Riz Ahmed die because he's a wonderful actor that I have been a fan of for years.
So all that said, Patrick Willems, pretty solid movie, in my opinion. Pretty solid movie. I mean, it has some nice things about it. I like it a lot.
It does. It's I like it with a lot of qualifiers caveats. There yeah. And caveats. It is the kind of thing where it's like, you know, it's always nice to see a, like, even if it has like a bunch of script issues, it's in 2022, it's nice to watch a big budget franchise blockbuster that has like a visual style and it's just like it feels like oh there's like actual like filmmaking happening here. This mm-hmm. is like,
and it's willing to take chances with the characters in the universe in
yeah.
a way that I think is rare these days.
And we hope happens more.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of Decoding TV. But we will be reviewing and recapping Andor, which is premiering on Disney Plus on September 21st, and episodes will come out Thursday night at latest, possibly earlier. We'll see. It might change from week to week. We'll try to get them done as quickly as we can. If you want to support this show, you can always go to decodingtv.com, sign up for a paid membership, get ad-free episodes and bonus episodes. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Find us on YouTube at youtube.com/decodingtv and also on Twitter, twitter.com/decodingtv. He's Patrick H. Willems. Find him at youtube.com/Patrick H. Willems and twitter.com/Patrick H. Willems. I am David Chen. You can find me online anywhere you go. But Patrick Willems, thanks for chatting with me today, man. I really appreciate it.
Dave, it's been a pleasure as always, and I'm excited to do this more over the next couple months.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next episode of Decoding TV.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.